Hello and welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burning. With me as always is Mike Montgomery.
And this week in my movie picks, this is finally the episode where we first hit a movie that's, you know, objectively good.
Objectively good, a possibly perfect film, even within its own standards. This is Untouchable. I don't even know if it can even be bested within its own franchise, which is really saying a lot. But honestly, that's just how special this one is.
Now, with that said, though, I could see where some people would put one of the other movies over this one.
Yeah, those people are wrong.
No, but in saying that.
Yeah.
If your alternative pick is not number six, I have questions.
Yeah, you can go with two. You can go with six. Hell, I can even see eight. I had to count there for a minute. I can even see eight. Sure. Why not? But nothing else comes even close to this. And quite frankly, yes, it takes either the greatest villain in Star Trek history or the end of the the war between Klingons and the Federation to even come close, anywhere close, to whales in space. This is Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home!
Avoid the planet Earth at all costs. We are under the attack of an orbiting probe.
Notify all stations. Starfleet emergency, red alert.
Earth is on the edge of destruction.
We cannot survive unless a way can be found to respond to the probe.
The key to saving the future.
Spock, you're talking about the end of every life on Earth.
Can be found only in the past.
We're going to attempt time travel.
Sulu, take us home.
These are the voyages of the crew of the Starship Enterprise.
Judging by the pollution content of the atmosphere, I believe we have arrived at the latter half of the 20th century.
Stardate 1986.
San Francisco.
Our own world is waiting for us to save it.
They have 24 hours.
Everybody remember where we parked. Break up.
To complete their mission.
It looked like a cadet review.
We will beam in tonight, collect the photons, and beam out.
I want you all to be very careful.
Without being discovered.
We have an intruder.
All right, who are you?
You're not exactly catching us at our best.
That much is certain.
This is an extremely primitive and paranoid culture.
What does it mean, exact change?
Many of their customs will doubtless take us by surprise.
We're ready for beam out.
My transporter power is down to minimal. I've got to bring in one at a time.
You're from outer space.
No, I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space. Let's do our job and get out of here.
Freeze! Tekov, can you hear me? Freeze! I've lost it.
Who are you?
You can't. Our next stop is the 23rd century.
Full power now, sir.
Shields at maximum.
Steady. Hold on tight, lassie.
Can we make breakaway speed?
That's all I can give you!
Warp 8. Warp 9.
Now.
Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home.
Classic 80. Classic 80 trailer.
Oh yeah. Now this got onto my list because this does have one thing over every other Star Trek movie in existence, which is, now I have of course just fairly recently turned 43 years old. I can still to this day remember coming out of the theater after seeing this movie when I was six.
Yeah. That's how you know it's a special one. Oh my, yes.
Exactly. Best movie in the franchise or not best movie in the franchise, you respect the hell out of this movie.
Yeah, this film is the ballsiest possible choice to this day. Like, nothing Star Trek has done has equaled this in terms of what? And yet landed it perfectly. This film has no villain, unlike every Star Trek movie that came after and a lot of the Star Trek TV that came after, especially like recent stuff, like New Trek likes its villains. This movie has no villain. It has a problem to solve, but that problem is not villainous. They solve the problem and they make new friends along the way. This film takes place completely separate, like in a completely separate world, more or less, than anything people come to see Star Trek in. It takes place in the contemporary present at that time of San Francisco, Reagan era America, and doesn't try to to hide it. It doesn't. It's so overt. It's filmed out on the street. There are people in this movie who didn't know they were in a movie. That's fantastic. They thought that there was just people wandering around asking very strange questions with very odd accents. This film doesn't have an Enterprise. This is a Star Trek TOS film that doesn't have an Enterprise on it until 30 seconds. At which point they just fly away and the movie ends. You don't get any of that goodness. Mm-mm. That's for another movie. That's to be wasted in the next one. The one we don't talk about. We don't talk about it.
Well, and I'm saying this as someone who enjoys the next one. I completely agree with you. Completely.
This film is the greatest gamble in Star Trek history, and despite being also, at least for the longest time, until I want to say First Contact, if not relatively, it remains the most successful Star Trek content ever created. If you inflate the box office to modern financials. I don't think that technically works anymore because the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, the first one, was so fucking big. But
yeah,
this defined so much of Star Trek in tiny little ways going forward that it's such, you would not get half the plots, solid half the plots of TNG, Deep Space Nine, or Voyager without this movie proving what can and can work when it comes to storytelling with modern audiences and Star Trek, especially time travel. And God, especially not having a villain, there are two entire Star Trek movies where there is not an overt villain. There's the first one, and we all know how that one kind of fared with critics and box office. Technically, it was a success. Is it remembered that way? No. And this one.
And actually, just additional note with that first one and a lot of the bitching in the fandom right now. You know how fans, when it comes to Discovery and Picard, keep insisting this is not what Gene Roddenberry wanted? You know what Gene Roddenberry did want? Roddenberry did want Star Trek the Motion Picture. So shut the fuck up.
Yeah, it's one of those complicated things where it's like, listen, if you got straight Gene Roddenberry, you would be asleep. Because the man had good ideas, but his script work and story work and character work was legendarily fucking terrible. Watching the original Cage. Just see how that goes. The most engrossing moment in the entire thing is when Laird Nimoy shouts, "The women!" It's just so out of character to see Spock just shout, "Women!" It doesn't work. And that's why even the studio, Desilu, was like, "Oh my fuck, no, Do it again. Do it again. Here's money. Do it again. if Gene got his way, Star Trek would have died long ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, season one of Next Generation, which includes the single most racist episode in the history of the entire franchise.
And that's saying something when we're talking about, like, when Star Trek is racist. Oh, my sweet lord. It's not just a little. It's full commitment.
And that's what Gene Roddenberry wanted.
Yeah.
So again, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. All respect to Gene. He took too many drugs. anyway, this, however, is what happens when you give the property. And what happens again, by the way, I should stress, what happens again? Because this is the work of a creative team firing at all cylinders. And it is like this beautiful meshing of like a director and a writer producer who they know exactly who these characters are. They know exactly how they want to tell the exact story. And without the love and attention given to the characters first and foremost by director Leonard Nimoy, Spock him fucking self, this movie would not work, because it is entirely the characters. Is that we know who these people are, and every moment feels unique. There's nothing more bones than having him go into a us contemporary, relatively them barbaric hospital, and him just wandering around giving away miracle cures and bitching at the other doctors. Fuck you. Fuck you. You know, and like his bed care, amazing. He's fantastic with the patients. Whips around and like eats the fucking head off a doctor. It's just I love it. having a Russian character who is incredibly naive. He's always been very like patient, naive, and easy to victimize. This is why Pavel Chekhov was the victim of Khan. He's a child. He's an adult body, but he's so innocent. And so to have him wandering around the streets of Reagan-era America with a black woman asking where they can find some nuclear vessels is just, that's brilliant, simple, brilliant character work. Everyone who meets them is immediately skeptical. The cop just stares at them, unsure what to do.
Everybody that they encounter is kind of giving this standard, you're obviously a tourist, I don't know how to answer, so I'm just going to ignore you.
Yeah.
But then you come to the motorcycle cop who's just calmly and coldly staring at them, going, I'm pretty sure I should arrest you.
and like,
but I don't know if I can.
And I love the woman who goes, where are the nuclear vessels in Alameda? And she goes, Alameda. And they go, that's what I said. And she just walks off. I could easily look it up right now, but I want to preserve in my head that was a rando who didn't watch Star Trek. They didn't recognize Walter Koenig and Nichelle Nichols, and was just like, what? It's in Alameda. You just said Alameda. I'm not dealing with this. I'm not dealing with this. To have Scotty. Oh my God. Scotty's got a lot of great scenes, especially in the movies. Like, movie Scotty is absolutely the best Scotty. Scotty on tour through that manufacturing facility and just like lording over it as this, you know, brilliant engineering professor. And then he gets the moment with the computer, and it's just the best thing ever. The best, because it starts with he's unfamiliar. He starts talking to the computer, obviously. Hands him, Bones hands him the mouse, and of course, I'll speak into this. It's beautiful. But when the guy who works there hands him the keyboard, you know, and Sky's just like, how quaint. And he starts pecking, you know, one finger, one finger, one finger. And then just amplifies right up to full keyboard warrior. You're like, that's smart. I really like that smart little thing of like, yeah, I mean, you know, he hasn't used this technology since he was like in school and they were showing him an antique. But he's fucking Scotty. Dude will memorize QWERTY in like 10 seconds. It's fine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, like, and with that scene, not only that, but viewers of a certain age will know good and goddamn well that that is not how a Mac works.
Ah, no, that is not how a Mac works.
You know good and goddamn well that all that that thing is doing is running through a prearranged set of graphical sequences. Do you care? Fuck no!
No, because I can believe that Scotty was like, within 5 seconds, he's hacked the fucking computer to start.
Yeah, yeah.
Within 5 seconds after that, he has fundamentally changed its operating software for the better. I kind of want, there's a lot of things that I want to have spun out of this into like a sequel episode during Voyager or something. And one of them would be like, Windows should be based off what Scotty did to the computer, not the design he gave. The design, sure, yeah, whatever. That went and made someone else. Scotty fundamentally rewrote operating software to do what he had to do. And then someone like Skynet found it and was like, and they, we'll call it Windows. You know,
the best thing is, if I remember my computer history and like the timing correctly,
yeah,
that could work.
Right. That's the great thing. Speaking of timing, I was looking up when, because I remember reading an article about like, transparent aluminum is a thing. It's aluminum oxide or some shit like that. But the patent for it was filed in 1980, and it was impossible to make at the time. So I just like the idea that like we can make it now. But it was so secretive as a concept that only the patent had been filed. It was impossible to manufacture. And yet, Harv Bennett and Leonard Nimoy came up with it in a way that it makes sense. It's a thing that they need. It's a thing that we would need. It's a thing that is possible. That, again, just another wonderful thing of Star Trek is possible. But going back to the return, like the unofficial official sequel episode that this should have had, it would have been great if there was someone ends up back in 1990s San Francisco. Voyager did that, if I recall.
Sort of. I believe they ended up in L.A. instead of San Francisco.
Close enough. Involving like a California State Patrol can work for this. So I want someone, a cop, to see their insignia, connect it to the insignia that they accidentally saw on like Kirk's vest or whatever. Say Kirk or Spock had their insignia somewhere that you could kind of see.
Yeah.
And I want one of the Voyager crew to get arrested for questioning in the disappearance and murder of the whale biologist.
I'm a whale biologist.
Who was last seen with two men wearing that same symbol.
You could totally do that. Where Uhura was wearing the symbol. I think you could do the same thing, but you would use federal agents, because she and Chekhov broke so many national security laws.
Yeah, Chekhov was actually like arrested and stuff. They would have gone through his pockets. And that would be...
Yeah, like, they straight up had his ID.
Yeah. Yeah, so, okay, it can go from there. It's just like, yeah, this symbol right here and the word Federation and Starfleet? The fuck?
Now, okay, I want to change what I just said a slight bit. They still have his ID. Because Chekhov's ID, his phaser, communicator, everything they confiscated from him, nobody at any point tries to get any of that equipment back. So that technology is still in 1986 San Francisco.
The American government specifically, like the Navy has that shit. Wow. That's something like, I'm sure some idiot these days would call that a plot hole, but I would just like there's no such thing as a plot hole in Star Trek. There's only more things that you can fill in. I would love a return episode to that. And admittedly, like one of my few complaints of modern Star Trek is you don't get the filler episodes where you'd be able to, on a budget, just film some shit downtown and just be like, yeah, it's someone fell through a time hole and went around the sun and ended up back in when are we writing this? Yeah, whatever. Yeah, a nice cheap episode that requires some writing.
And you remember the original Sirius episode, A Piece of the Action? And the end of the episode, when they realize McCoy left his communicator behind, and they panic over forgetting just one piece of equipment?
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, now they're just like, no, I'm tired. Let's get the fuck out of here. And that's the great thing, is that attitude is not necessarily what we see from these characters usually. As much as Shatner seems to be the romantic and heroic, you know, center of this film, I maintain he's the fucking comedy. Like, everyone in this is the comedy. The comedy is intrinsic to their characters. But he gets so many great comedic lines and gets to have such great energy with Spock as a straight man who also has some great comedic lines that his character, of course, just doesn't fully comprehend the context of. I don't think they've ever allowed him to have that much fun since. I don't think he even allowed himself to have that much fun in the next movie. And he was the director and wrote the damn thing.
You know what? I don't think it's that he didn't allow himself to do it in the next movie. I think it's he tried way too hard to do it. But speaking of the comedy, like, for me, viewing the movie for this episode was probably the first time I realized and appreciated how much of a comedy this actually is. And just the simple fact that you have the original, you have Kirk and Spock trying to arrange to get the two whales, George and Gracie, named of course after George Burns and Gracie Allen. And the entire time, Kirk and Spock are doing very Burns and Allen-esque vaudeville comedy.
Mm-hmm. As they just try, like, the plot of this is so painfully simple. Kirk and Spock travel to an aquarium. They go back to the ship. They go to lunch. They go back to the ship. They go and get the whales. Other people do a couple of other tasks. This film is literally a weekend of running errands and getting lunch.
Not only that, but also, I mean, number one, you try to do this movie today and have these characters do all of these errands on $100.
Is that a lot?
You know what? I think the only way that the moment where Kirk pawns the glasses from Wrath of Khan, instead of is that a lot, I would have liked to have him go 100 what?
100 what? Oh, 100.
Because, of course, Kirk, of course, would has no concept of money.
And although I'm sure there was some earlier mention, this might be the first true statement that there's no money in the future. And then it got complicated. And of course, there's like original season or series episodes where, if I recall, like their extra pay all comes in, their danger pay and all of that. And they're all like counting their money and being like, what are you going to do with your pay? And it's like, oh dear. Let's pretend this never happened, because it raises questions later.
I mean, like Voyage Home, in just by itself, is the entire continuity issue around Star Trek and money.
Yeah.
Because you have, like we said, Kirk in the pawn shop, clearly knows what money is, has some concept of it, understands how it works and all that.
Knows to go to a pawn shop to sell crap quick. Yeah.
And we jump ahead to the dinner scene where they're getting ready to leave, and Jillian goes, I suppose they don't use money in the 23rd century. Well, we don't. But you just knew to go get money.
Right? Yeah, it's one of those great things of, like, even when he first realizes it, when he's going to go sell the glasses, he's like standing in the middle of the street and goes, they use money in the 20th century. And it's almost like this whole thing of like, shit, I forgot they wear clogs. It's so foreign as a concept. It's so not something. Right. Why are my feet wet? Rah, clogs.
With the basic plot, and on the off chance that we have listeners who have not seen this movie before, very quickly, this is the third part of the, what's at least unofficially, the Genesis trilogy.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And the best thing about the Genesis trilogy, just to be, like, really clear, is this is the perfect trilogy that was not planned in any way, and that this is how the Genesis trilogy quote-unquote ends, a completely unrelated fucking plot, just goes to show. It perfectly wraps up the storyline begun with Wrath of Khan. Absolutely, yes, it puts a bow on it, and it does it effectively. But if you are, like, stepping into this expecting some sort of continuation of the story specifically,
but, like, the movie opens with the crew still on Vulcan, where we left them at the end of Search for Spock, and they're basically getting ready to go back to Earth and face the consequences of their actions. So, within about 5-10 minutes of the opening of this movie, we have a far better character understanding than the entire runtime of the motion picture.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We get the origin of the Vulcan education suite, where you bombard a student with questions as they turn around and answer them as quickly as possible. I really liked when things get brought back and updated really, really well. And this was such a small little, like, specific thing for Spock. He literally died, and they had to rebuild his mind. They had to rebuild Spock. And so this is just some basic, like, testing, but to then later add it to the fuller canon as, like, no, this is how every Vulcan child is educated. It's like, no wonder they're just always on edge despite apparently having no emotions. If I was raised for, like, a decade plus having questions just fucking incessantly badgered at me, yeah, I'd be pretty testy too.
Well, remember, Vulcans having no emotions is a myth.
Yeah, no, they have them under control, but that kind of rage? Mm-mm, no. Mm-mm.
That kind of rage is why they have them under control.
they name the ship the Bounty. That's fun.
I mean, classic literature reference. Mm-hmm. What is more Star Trek?
Yeah, not only a classic literature reference, it's a classic naval and historic reference as well. The Bounty actually did happen. And more importantly, the mutineers on the Bounty won and to this day remain living at the island near Tahiti, or in Tahiti, where they went after they stole the fucking boat. And they integrated with the population, and the population there is still to this day so fucking anti-British and very much just like, yeah, go fuck yourselves. We're the Bounty, bitches. And I just love that. Like, Like, it worked out for the bounty, and so it is the most badass thing to call a stolen starship. And to be very clear, one of the other things, like, there's a line at the end of this we'll get to, but in the comics that were running between the movies that were supposed to be entirely canon, the comic writers were like, okay, they blew up the Enterprise. They have a bird of prey, and Spock's mind has been erased. Well, we'll write a couple stories where that gets fixed. They end up stealing the Excelsior and using that extensively for the 2 years in the comics between this movie and the previous one. So
yeah,
for 2 years in the comics, the official comics, they were on the Excelsior. And Spock was there and perfectly fine until he gets, like, infected with a virus that returns him to the state they found him at the end of Search for Spock. So they brought him back to Vulcan, left the Excelsior somewhere that Starfleet could pick it up, and essentially were like, hey, isn't that our bird of prey? Cool. All right, so we're right back where we started. It was like, bravo, you had your cake, you ate it, you showed it off, you smeared it on your face.
Oh, 80s DC is a beautiful thing.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug.
Let even our apparent love interest, whose name I can never remember because they barely say it.
If I remember, even in IMDb, she's just listed as Jillian. But I think the full name is Dr. Jillian Taylor.
Okay, Dr. Jillian Taylor, you better put a doctor on it. She's a whale biologist.
I'm a whale biologist.
She remains the greatest one-note character. And by one-note, I don't mean she's a flat character. She's used once. But she remains the greatest character in Star Trek. Simply for the fact that, like, number one, she absolutely had, like, she was instrumental to them solving the problem. She, like, this couldn't have happened without her. So she's intrinsic to the plot. She dumps Kirk. She uses James T. Kirk, the biggest womanizer in history across the galaxy, to hitch a ride to the future and then stay there, where she is likely a founding, like, member or designer of Cetacean Ops. Like, an entire level that is found on major Starfleet ship. Until Lower Decks, no one got to see it. It was always just a fun little joke for, like, really observant nerds when they were looking at the Elkar's list of floor options, or at the blueprint of an Enterprise, and it said Cetacean Ops, and you're like, whales? And I was like, yeah, that's the floor that the whales live on. And now we know that there are dolphins wearing full uniforms swimming around the ship, engineering shit. And it's that's amazing. She's a founder of that branch of Starfleet. And, like, she's so incredible. I like to think the Time Valiant, whoever, the Time Cops, the Starfleet Temporal Bureau, whatever, looked at her and went, well, let's check out the future. Oh, fuck, no, she's not going back. Mm-mm. No, we can't. No. No, we can't tell you why, but she's not allowed to leave the future. It's just, that's amazing. That's the kind of stuff I want to see more. I want to see someone be like, fuck you. I want the perfect future too, you asshole.
I think my favorite thing there was how you refer to her as a one-note character when she was originally two separate characters.
Yes, one of them was Eddie Murphy.
Yep. And as far as why that didn't happen, I have heard two versions. I don't know if it's one or the other or some combination of both, but it was either they tried to bring in Eddie Murphy and he was too busy filming The Golden Child to do it. A more recent version of this that I had heard was that they had invited Eddie Murphy to come in as this kind of hippie-ish Save the Whales type professor, and Jillian would still be there as the love interest, but he would be the one helping the crew, and I think ends up going to the future. But Murphy said no because he wanted the full Star Trek experience, like the uniform, the makeup, all of it.
Yeah, and that is entirely fair. If I got invited to do Star Trek and was told I don't even get to play an alien, let alone like walk around on a future set, there would at least be some disappointment. And if you're Eddie Murphy in the 80s, that disappointment can mean, actually, no, fuck you, I'm not doing it.
Yep.
And there is an entire subgenre of classic movies, classic 80s films, where, and Eddie Murphy was actually considered for the role, or this role was literally written for Eddie Murphy. For instance, Winston in The Ghostbusters. That's supposed to be Eddie Murphy. That character was written for Eddie Murphy.
And from what Ernie Hudson has said about his time on Ghostbusters, I'm not going to say Eddie Murphy dodged a bullet,
but it was
what? Because yeah, intentional or accidental, there was stuff there that was kind of racist as fuck.
Yeah, kind of. Yes. Even though he does get the amazing line, "I have seen shit that will turn you white." Spoken to a white Italian mayor. Terrific line. But yeah, oh my god, what a great character to get out of two different characters. Like, if she had just remained the love interest, that would have been superfluous, pointless, very 1960s, and just like,
yeah,
absolutely forgettable. Combining them, giving her the ultimate agency, not only to save the future, save the world, save the whales, but to then just be like, oh no, I am not the fish out of water. You were the fish out of water in my time. I was taking advantage of you, and now I'm going to go work at the Daystrom Institute. Fuck off, bitches. Brilliant. Just a small passing choice that absolutely makes the ending of this like just better, so much better.
Oh, and as long as we're talking about representation and so forth, we haven't addressed the probe all that much, because in Star Trek films, it's a rule that you have to have a massive probe or alien something that just wipes out Starfleet in a blink. And here, of course, it's an alien probe, and the first ship to encounter it is the Saratoga. And I wanted to bring up the Saratoga because this brings us Madge Sinclair, I believe, playing the first female captain seen on screen in Star Trek.
I believe you are right, and it's so matter of fact that it's not even like really addressed. I love how this film is really good at just matter of facting its way through stuff, and it builds aspects. Like, the Klingon ambassador in this comes back in the sixth film. It's just a small thing, but it's so important for building this larger universe, especially when the design schemes of like bridges and interiors change with every goddamn movie, especially since like, one, they have to keep rebuilding the interiors for some damn reason. Two, some of them have much less money.
No, I know the somehow, some way, Paramount was utterly incapable of properly storing the bridge sets, because they kept getting destroyed.
Like, it's just ridiculous. You build so many of these sets and they all, it's like jumping between fucking iterations of Doctor Who. They're vastly different. Same basic layout, but this one has white walls. This one has green, like, neon accents and gray. This one looks like it's made of fucking plywood. You know, there's no consistency, and we don't get one that I'm actually happy with until Undiscovered Country. And at that point, you're just using Next Generation set.
Oh, man.
We have to talk about the elephant in the room, and that is the one person who connects this film to the MCU. The one person who has the career we all want. One person who came out of nowhere and has somehow become a memorable piece of Star Trek, a much beloved piece of Star Trek, despite practically not existing on screen. We have to talk about Kirk Thatcher.
Oh, we absolutely do, because through this man, now you mentioned the MCU, but I'm telling you right now, that's not the only place you can go.
Oh no, you can go much more.
Through this man, you could justify bringing in Star Wars.
Yeah.
You could justify RoboCop. You can justify a Star Trek and Pigs in Space crossover.
Yeah. It's obscene. It's obscene. Okay, so first of all, the very simple thing that we'll get into. Kirk Thatcher, for those wondering, is the punk. He's the punk. He's the guy who's playing his music too loud. You may recognize him from a cameo in Picard last season when, again, he's the punk. Except this time he's a little better mannered because he remembers that time that he got fucked up on a bus for playing his music way too loud. Lovely little return. However, he also plays a music listening to somewhat punk guy, the exact same character, to be very fair, in Spider-Man Homecoming. And when you start getting known for playing this one background character and you start crossing over into different universes, you become something so much more. And if you look into his history and how he got this job, it becomes increasingly difficult to claim that reality isn't a simulation that he is playing. This is his reality. And it's built around him getting to just geek out. He got into movies because he made friends with the production designer for Star Wars. What? Next thing you know, he's the producer on Voyage Home. Why? Because he made friends with Leonard Nimoy. How did he become? That's it. That's it. This guy has to be the most charming motherfucker on Earth. He has been, for the last 20 years, the on-again, off-again producer of The Muppets. That's what he does for money. He just produces The Muppets. What the fuck?
And as I was more or less saying to you slightly before we started recording, like, even you just go on a Google, do an image search of this man. His wardrobe choices. I have never met this man. I have never spoken to or heard this man speak outside of this one scene in Star Trek IV. I want to hang out with this man so badly.
This man wrote both the best and worst punk song ever because he wrote and performed the song that his character is listening to.
Yeah.
It is a terrible punk song, but it is also the perfect 80s punk song to be playing for an audience that intrinsically does not like punk, like for the entire purpose of not liking it. Just where is the future? The things we've done instead. Let's just push the button. We'd be better off dead. 'Cause all That is perfect. That is the definitive punk song. Kirk Thatcher, I hate you, but only because I want to be you.
I mean, really, if there's a pure, understandable reason to hate someone, that's kind of it.
Is there any way I can take in your essence and become your power?
Right? Yeah. right?
What a dude. And yeah, like, that's the essence. That is the essence of this movie. A rando dude who gets to produce Star Trek, then has a career both just making Muppets and reappearing as the caricature he played in the Star Trek he got to produce. Not fair, not taken seriously, entirely ridiculous, and yet charming and beloved. None of it should work, and it all does.
Yeah, and with his appearance in Picard, I have seen people complain about how it's so anachronistic because, you know, like, nobody listens to music that way on the bus, and
number one,
as someone who does not own a car and therefore relies on public transportation, the fuck they don't.
Yeah, no, that has not changed. They may not be rocking a boombox anymore, but you'd be amazing how fucking loud some headphones can get.
And if I remember right, he is using a boombox in the reference scene, and this is where I get to point two, because do I care? Fuck no.
No.
Because, like, I could see how a lot of viewers would not get the reference without the boombox, and therefore, I am completely fine with it.
Yeah. Also, and, like, okay, I usually buy from used bookstores. I rarely go into a Chapters. A couple of months ago, I was in there because I got a gift card for Christmas, and they were selling a, like, reversions, new versions of Ghetto Blasters, which is what they call it, Ghetto Blasters. Like, one's the size of a fucking Casio. You know, this will hurt your spine if you carry it, but you're supposed to carry it. And it had like, oh, you can put cassettes in it, you can put A-tracks in it, you can put CDs in it, you can plug in your MP3s here, it's got Bluetooth. It's like, if you had given this to an old school punk back in the day, my God, the damage they could do with it.
I mean, listen, the simple fact is that you can buy phone cases where you put your phone in, turn it around, and the back of it is literally a Game Boy.
Yeah.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah. If Buddy wants to have a Ghetto Blaster for some fucking reason, that's consumer's choice, baby.
Yeah, and I mean, with that and referencing Star Trek IV, there was only one thing that I wish that, like, they didn't do it on Picard, but I kind of wish they had. I would have loved to have maybe Raffi and Seven either walk past or encounter a group of fishermen, and one of them is, like, telling a story about this green winged demon thing that suddenly appeared over their fishing boat like 30 however many years in the past.
That would be good. If I recall, they're all speaking like Norwegian, so that's a shame.
According to IMDb, it's Finnish.
God, it would be, wouldn't it?
I mean, either or.
Scandinavian. They're doing Scandinavian talkie talk. But yeah, that would be like, or like they mentioned whales and someone's like, whales are extinct, and just have like one of them look back and be like, what? You know, how can they be extinct? They're in our, what? You know, that would be a great Raffy frustration freak out of like, da-da-da! And then Seven's just like, yeah, she doesn't know what she's talking about. this film has a soundtrack that I swear was stolen from a Christmas movie. It's got elements of Star Trek in it, but like, oh my God, what an 80s Christmas movie soundtrack.
I mean, it's so bright and cheery that, frankly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, this movie is so bright and cheery. There are two moments in it when the entire crew is just on screen laughing. That's it. A joke has not been told. They're just doing the old television thing of like, ah, the plot's done. You know, it's amazing.
Oh, yeah, and also the fascinating thing is how each movie has its own completely unique main theme and, like, general score.
Mm-hmm.
And they are so specific to that movie. Take the score from Star Trek IV and transplant it onto Star Trek, say, I don't know, 2? And see what happens.
Oh, that wouldn't work.
No!
Take the score from Star Trek IV and put it over Insurrections.
There is only one movie where you could get away with that.
Hmm.
Take the score from Star Trek IV, put it onto Star Trek Nemesis. It still wouldn't work, but nobody talks about Nemesis.
That'd be great. Just Tom Hardy trying to be menacing, and there's some motherfucker going ham on a xylophone. Really upbeat and shit. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yeah. Oh. This is the perfect Star Trek, and even the like people who made it were like, no, this is the best Star Trek because it's the most universal Star Trek. You don't have to be into Star Trek to enjoy it. This is the first Star Trek that was shown in the Soviet Union, and they loved it. Specifically, apparently, the line, the only universal constant is the bureaucratic need for pettiness, comma, will get a freighter. And the Soviets were like, da, that is true.
Again, the thing that just buried itself into 6-year-old me's brain and just stayed there was Kirk's, my friends, we've come home.
Here I thought it was going to be double dumbass on you.
Amazingly, no, like, my all-time favorite Enterprise is the refit Constitution, and I think this scene was why. But I did see a post on Facebook that I wanted to get your thoughts on, which is, you take that same scene, but instead of panning to the Constitution Enterprise, it's an Excelsior class. Does that scene still work?
Not in the least. Not in the least. Like
thank you!
The line as it is even works with the comic book continuity, the convoluted comic book continuity in which they would have had to fly in the Excelsior. Like, when they made the joke, why would you want to? If you pay attention to the comic canon and consider it to be a part of it, then they're actually speaking from like experience of like, I don't want to go back to it. I hate the Excelsior. You know, like,
yeah.
Everything about that line works. And yeah, you have to have them back on the, obviously it's not the original Enterprise. That thing burned the fuck up on the Genesis planet. But a refit that was renamed. That's great. That's what really ties the entire trilogy together. Like, yes, there's at the beginning of it when they decide to own up to their crimes and go back home. And that gets influenced or interrupted by, I like to consider this is like the 40-minute crisis. Like, we get a whole movie and they get a couple of days. But on Starfleet's side, I kind of want it to be like, yeah, something went wrong. We lost communications. Kirk showed up. I don't know. He flew around the sun. A few minutes later, everything was back. And we have whales now? Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, how was your day? You know, and it's...
Yeah, no,
like, it's bookended around this whole story. But it perfectly brings you right back to where you were in 1982.
Precisely.
Fuck yeah. Yeah,
lately, you always hear so much about how the Enterprise itself is a character.
Yeah.
When I saw that Facebook post, my first thought was, no, there is only one possible ship you can have in that scene. I don't want to hear about how, oh, Starfleet wanted to, like, reward them with the most modern ship they had, whatever. No, there's only one place that you put this crew.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah, exactly. There was very much the intent originally to put them on the Excelsior and to have that be the next ship that they fly for a while. But it's not the same. It just isn't the same. And people have been pushing that since Wrath of Khan. Like, they were like, no, put them on a new ship. Put them on a new ship. Cooler ship. Newer ship. And it's like, no. Absolutely not. No. It has to be a Constitution or a Constitution refit because the age is part of it. It's necessary. And I guess that's another thing that bothers me about Final Frontier is we get so much growth and change from these characters during that trilogy. They should come out different. Like, paradigms have shifted. But when we get to Final Frontier, it's right back to, like, episodic Star Trek. And, like, if need be, take Final Frontier and just, like, put it before Wrath of Khan. Just literally put it before Wrath of Khan. There's nothing that says you don't necessarily, like, it can't go there. There, you know.
No.
It's far closer to a classic kind of Star Trek story like that, and it doesn't interfere with the trilogy. But the trilogy should end with them having grown to the point that, like Star Trek as a story has grown. The last three films show the full growth and maturity of Star Trek and its real potential. And then you follow it up with Undiscovered Country, where you go, and here's how we tell a serious real-world story to cap this whole thing off. That would have been such a great just like growth curve. And yeah, Final Frontier just feels like a stumble after this amazing ending and brilliant re-approach to Star Trek and its cliches, like having Kirk get dumped. That's great. That's so against his type, and then we just kind of loop right back into it, and it's like, ah, damn it. Imagine if the next time you saw these characters, they had broken up as a group instead of like Final Frontier. What they get home, they finally get back to their ship, and the next you hear, oh no, Sulu's off captaining his own thing, Spock's off doing like semi-ambassador shit, Kirk's like, you know, running whatever the fuck he's doing. And it's like the happy ending we got was immediately spoiled by what? Bureaucratic pettiness. Just, you know, like, yeah. You go full circle and end up right back where they were, as in not a crew anymore, and Kirk is stuck behind a desk. That's funny.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely is. And it's that Kirk's line of, once you get in the captain's chair, you do anything you can to stay there. Don't let you take them out of there, because once you're there, you can make a difference. And Kirk keeps getting pulled out of the chair.
Right? And that would make the entire, like, Wrath Genesis trilogy about what happens when Kirk won't let go of the chair. This entire ridiculous thing happens. The world is nearly destroyed twice. You know, like, the Genesis device would have been used against Earth. That's a big thing.
Yep.
The whales wouldn't have saved our asses, and not Rama would have done whatever the fuck it was doing. That thing's enormous, by the way. I love it. I love how they literally stole an Arthur C. Clarke creation. And we're like, yeah, fuck it. We'll just throw it in there. We did it before.
And I also love how at the end, like, as when the probe receives the whale song and leaves. Now, like, yes, you do see, like, space dock's power is restored, and presumably all the ships inside are restored and so forth. There's still a number of Starfleet ships out there with entirely dead crews. Like, I know that they don't want to talk about that, but...
That's why I like to think of this as, like, the 40-minute crisis. Because it's just a long enough that they all got their air back. It's like, okay, I can breathe again. I almost died there, but I didn't.
Well, did they all get their air back? Because they're at one point, you see a message from a Hindu captain, who's talking about how their engineer is trying to rig up a primitive solar sail.
I love that one. Yeah, just trying to some massive solar sail to drag a fucking Federation ship around. Do you imagine the size of that thing?
And like, I mean, like, there's that, but there's also, again, the simple fact that, I'm sorry, I don't care how fast that probe is going on its return trip. If that sail didn't work, that ship is a coffin.
See, that's how Voyager should have ended. Like, they should have gotten to the point that, like Janeway's rigged the Voyager with fucking sails, and it just, like, literally sails in. She's, like, holding on to some wires on the outside, screaming at a war yodel. Holy shit, Catherine's back.
I mean, as stupid as that idea is on the surface, at the same time, It's better than coming in inside a Borg ship that plot conveniently blows up at exactly the right time.
in my case, she comes in. They still come in the Borg ship, but that is entirely showmanship. She's like wearing the corpses of her enemies.
Can we have Ride of the Valkyries playing on all communication channels for no reason?
Oh, fuck, it's Janeway. Da 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 da. I can smell coffee and fear.
Oh my god, that'd be so... honestly, like, it's dumb, but it's so amazing.
Just, she's so fucking crazy. She enters a room, Worf is in it, and he gets thrown through a wall just immediately. Just, whoop! She doesn't even touch him. He gets picked up by circumstance and thrown against the wall. The fuck was that? Oh, Catherine's in town.
I mean, let's be honest, though. It would have been, I think DS9 Worf, this still kind of happened. You could look at that man and he gets thrown into a wall.
Your wife is dead.
Or and before that, like, he gets told no and he's like, I didn't ask anything. No. You're just denied.
Just no. Oh my god. So good. This movie is a classic for a reason. There is a specific reason that people who do not even like Star Trek enjoy this. This is a terrific film. If you stripped out all of the Star Trek IP, it's still a terrific film. And that can said for most Star Trek. It just doesn't work without, like, all of the iconography, the characters, and all of that. If you remove the names from this and the intro and outro, you just get some fun sci-fi, some great fish out of water jokes. You could easily just be like, oh, they're from Mars. That's it. Mars needs whales.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, you 100% could. And it's so fascinating with even just with the comedy elements, how you have that utterly cliche element of the characters express that they have a problem, and then the solution to that problem instantly appears. It shouldn't work. It should not work.
I love that, first of all, Sulu knows how to fly a Huey. Why? I don't know. Fuck it. He's a pilot. He can fly anything. Why not? Second, I always like to assume that he got that helicopter by having sex with the guy he was talking to. He was flirting with him. That was flirting. Come on.
Oh, yeah. Like, I'm sorry. That had to be. And you kind of just want to imagine that he ended up just leaving the helicopter in Golden Gate Park for that guy to pick up.
That reminds me, like, an understated line in this is when she first drops Kirk off in the park, and she's like, this is where you'll be? In the park? And he's like, yeah. And it's like, oh, it's a homeless person. You picked up a crazy homeless person. Well done, doctor. You've got great standards.
I mean, I know she does specifically refer to herself as the sucker for hard luck cases, but come on.
Yeah, yeah. A guy who's burned out on too much LDS and his crazy homeless friend named the Admiral. Truly. Listen, San Francisco has had some crazy people, such as Emperor Norton. But holy damn, lady.
But, I mean, I love how they're standing at the bus stop. Spock goes to use the map to try to figure out where the whales are. And the bus advertising the Cetacean Institute Museum just immediately appears.
Yeah. It's a comedy. It's that's the best thing about it. Like, when I say it's a comedy, it's not only because it's got jokes. It's got jokes. But its approach, it's Shakespearean comedy. It's classical comedy where everything will work out in the end. Fate is working with you on your benign behalf. And everything carries through. Nothing goes wrong in this until Pavel falls. He doesn't even get shot. You'd think that they would shoot him. No, he falls. No. And they bring him to a hospital. They don't arrest him and, like, hold on to him in a cell until he dies. They send him to a civilian hospital. This Russian spy might die. Ooh, we better get him some help. It's the Cold War after all.
Well, remember, his operating room was under guard, but on the other hand, you're absolutely right. That should have been a military hospital.
Like, you know, and it's just small things like that that allow, like, it doesn't break the story. It doesn't pull you out.
No.
Everything moves smoothly, especially, like, for 80s plotting and all that. But yeah, this is a true comedy in the sense that everything ends up right in the end, with the twist that the guy gets the girl, but the girl gets to do whatever the fuck she wants and buggers off. You know, that's terrific. That's a good comic ending. And for those who have not seen a lot of Leonard Nimoy's films, I absolutely suggest that you go see like Look Who's Talking, because these are very basic comedies that understand the art form on a beautiful, like, scholarly level. These are perfect examples of comedy. Wah! Amazing. Leonard Nimoy was a brilliant comedian, and you can tell it from his timing and performances on, like, episodes of The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah. No, I was just going to say, like, with a lot of these scenes that I referenced, like, just the timing is so smooth and so perfect. Like, and the most blatant yet perfect example of this, I think, has to be Scotty, Sulu, and McCoy walking along the street and kind of basically going, you know, where are we going to find the materials to build this whale tank? And immediately, not only does the solution just instantly appear, it's a giant Yellow Pages ad that flat out says, can't find it?
Yeah. But like, whereas this could be done horribly wrong, like Converse shoes in iRobot, you know, it really on the nose marketing that just feels inorganic. They only look at that because there's a door in it and a couple are fighting. They are fighting unrelated to the plot. Entirely unrelated. Yeah. They're having a domestic dispute. And the door closes while they're watching, and it completes the image of this ad that they're and then it comes into view for them. And that's such smart, organic advertising to tell a story. It's not just there to get the fucking money. It's world building. And it's world building based on something that they actually did. That's smart. That is a production designer who pays attention to the world around them. That's fucking good. And there's a bunch of things like that in this that you don't even think of it. I can't even think of them right now, but I know they are there. There is more product placement in this, obviously, than there's ever been in Star Trek up to this point, because products don't exist in Star Trek. There aren't brands like that. That's all capitalist pig dog thinking, and it's dead. It's long in the past. But now that they can go back, there's tons of little things that you don't even think about because it's so organically built. Oh, I love this film.
Oh, yeah, and like after the scene at the Italian restaurant when Jillian drops off Kirk back at the park, I don't know why, I don't know exactly what it is, but there's something about Kirk bringing leftover pizza back for the rest of the crew that's just damn funny to me.
Right? I brought pizza.
I'm watching this scene, and it kept making me think of, like, a mama bird bringing food back to the nest for the babies.
Well, it's kind of like, it's the most, like, this is all their jobs. They're at work. He is their manager, and he's brought pizza because they're having a run. It's amazing.
And oh yeah, no, like, and even the stuff that by today's standards is bad, but back then they had to do it for whatever reason.
Yeah, there's a hard R word in this movie.
I audibly winced at that, and
I forgot, make no mistake, that was there.
Yeah, and make no mistake, that's not what I'm about to be referring to. The Klingon, this bit with the Klingon ambassador in the opening.
Yeah.
Now that entire scene is basically an info dump that they tended to put into the movies I believe for international markets where they may not have actually gotten the movies that came before, or not like didn't get the trailers or something, but it's there specifically to tell you everything that happened before.
Yeah.
And number one, this is probably the smoothest and most organic variation of that that I've seen in 80s film.
Apparently, like to specifically talk about that, the trailer, the international trailer for this movie also included that, and it was flawless, like seamless storytelling of you're doing a movie trailer, but somehow your trailer includes the two previous movies. Just amazing.
But also, you know the cliche of like security footage that they're watching on a monitor, and you're looking at it and going, there's no possible way that that camera could exist.
Yeah.
I got such a kick out of that here because the footage that they're showing, there's only one possible place that that could come from, which is basically the Klingon ambassador is using footage that was recorded by the Bird of Prey that Kirk captured to damn Kirk in front of the Federation Council.
Yeah, I like the idea. He sent in that and then recovered, like, the black box from the Enterprise and sent in the interior footage. And it was just like, it clearly shows fuck the Klingons. And the Klingons were like, oh, shit. Fuck this shit.
Again, that shouldn't work, but it's hilarious.
It shouldn't work, and I hate when that happens, especially in Star Trek, where it's like, come on, just film some extra shit. But it worked here because we immediately move past it and into a completely different setting.
Yeah.
And so we don't end up like seeing those issues reappear in forms of cost-cutting maneuvers. The rest of the film is a cost-cutting maneuver.
And also that is very much the era where if they were able to reuse footage from a previous movie, make no fucking mistake, they were going to reuse it. That's in the rules. This is the fourth movie. You don't get to complain about it anymore.
Yeah. We'll reuse the entire launch sequence from Motion Picture all over again. We don't care. Oh, that's the climactic explosion of the bad guy's ship in 6? Now it's the climactic explosion in 7, too. Fuck you.
6, 7, a couple episodes of Next Generation.
Yeah. Get a lot and of exploding that Bird of Prey.
And that launch sequence, they could have put that footage into every single movie, including the Abrams reboots. And I would give them extra points.
They should have put it
I would
in
give them
every
extra
movie.
Points for doing it.
Yeah. They should have put it in every movie, and when they get to this one, put it twice. Put it at the beginning, and then cut to Kirk and crew, like, standing off to the side being like, God, I wish that was ours. Like, full 5 minutes of it, and then the joke, and then end it with the same damn footage at end, leading into the relaunch. Terrible. Yeah, this is the perfect Star Trek film. This is possibly one of the most perfect 80s films out there. If you haven't seen it, my God, give it a watch. There's no rating for this. No rating is capable. It's The Voyage Home. If you know of it, you get it. If you don't know of it, get the fuck out of here and go watch it.
Oh, there is a rating. The rating is this. This is the movie that introduced me to Star Trek. This might be the movie that introduced me to, like, mainstream science fiction in general. And that is a powerful, extremely important thing that very few movies will ever be able to claim for anyone.
Speaking of which, what kind of crap are we watching next?
Well, and I'm glad that you specified crap, because...
oh, no.
We're going to be taking the fascinating, interesting turn of a movie that I loved as a kid, but have not watched since I was a kid.
Ooh, dangerous.
Now, we had talked in the past about how at some point we should do a wrestling movie, since we're both wrestling fans. And there is one wrestling movie that I've just been dying to do. So, but we're going back. Now, you may think The Wrestler? No, fuck no. That's a good movie. We don't do that.
Yeah, that's an award-winning movie. That shit's tragic, well-performed, and has real-life connections to Jake the Snake. That's a different, very depressing fucking episode.
Yeah. Yeah, no. We're not doing that. Now, wrestling comedy? Ready to Rumble? No. Fuck WCW. I'm going even further back.
At some point, we're coming back to Ready to Rumble, because, oh my god.
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, at some point, sure. But I'm thinking of essentially the film that walked so that Ready to Rumble could run. We're going back to the oeuvre of Hulk Hogan.
You're gonna say it. I can feel it in my bones.
Now, I know that when I say that, you and probably most of our listeners are going to think Suburban Commando.
Yeah.
Oh, no. No.
Oh my.
I have three words for you that are both the title and the only way that we can do the next episode. No holds barred!
Oh, fuck. should have taken Suburban Commando.
You know, and like this is like this. Suburban Commando has been done so many times by so many people, but if you want to witness the beautiful cocaine fueled insanity that both was this movie and things that happened around this movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's no holds barred, damn it.
Well, that's going to be a thing. Oh, fuck. And if you are interested in feeling the pain of the mat and want to join us for the next episode.
Oh, you don't know. You don't know. And make no mistake, when I say you don't know, make no mistake, those three words are going to come up next time in so many sweet, sweet, senseless, insane ways.
Oh my god. So look forward to that. Email us and contact us. Oh god, I'm in a world of suffering already.
Now, if you do want to email us with any questions, comments, begging me not to do this, we can be reached at realgeekshfx@gmail.com, on Twitter at realgeekshfx. You can find me directly at The Maritime Lord on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Hive, or themaritimelord@gmail.com.
And, you know, I'm around. Usually at Friday in Halifax on Twitter and Crash and Burn everywhere else.
Mind stopping that noise.
The sins of all our fathers picked up on us the sun. The only choice we're given is how many megatons.
Excuse me.
And I
mind stopping that damn noise.
And I say screw you.
out.